A trap.
That was pretty much what I'd expected, though the language problem was a new twist. We kept moving until we'd reached the midway point, and then stopped. Since the strangers hadn't attacked yet, I held up a hand and waved at them. We should have brought a white flag, observed Graham. They aren't even human, I replied. They probably wouldn't recognize it. We don't even know what their custom for parties might involve, or if they have one. A rapid-fire series of metallic clicks rang out from the enemy, as though all of them had tapped on their armor in quick succession. Myra answered my unspoken question.
That was some sort of signal, an order to stand ready but not to attack, yet.
Can you tell where their leader is? I asked. Standing at ground level, I could only see their front rank, and even that was largely covered by their shields. With my mage sight, I searched through the ranks behind that, but I couldn't detect any obvious movement or arrangement that indicated who their commander was.
There are around 20 of them that radiate some degree of authority scattered throughout, said Myra. Near the left of the center, there are three that stand close together. One of them seems to be directing the other two.
Try as I might, I couldn't figure out which three she meant.
Let me link with you, said Myra helpfully. I can show you.
She reached out toward me with her hand. Slowly, I took it. Myra had given her enough of her power to allow Myra to create a form with physical substance. Her hand felt real in my grasp, though my mage sight could easily detect that it was merely a construct of Aethar. Lowering my mental shield, I touched her mind, and images began flowing between us.
There, she told me. Those three.
Mage sight was a thing of form, almost touch. There was no true color in it, and when there was, it was a product of the human mind interpreting different flavors of Aethar. The three Myra was indicating lit up with mental colors, two of them red, while the one between them seemed golden. Studying them for a moment, I made a note of their Aethar, ensuring I could recognize them in the future. Then I broke the link between Myra and myself. Thank you, I told her. Seconds later, there was movement. One of the three began to make his way forward, and two others bearing shields and axes followed on either side of him.
That's the second in command, relayed Myra. The leader and third in command are staying behind while he comes to meet us. He's bringing a small honor guard with him.
I could have guessed as much, but I nodded my thanks to her, keeping my eyes on the soldiers in front of us. A gap opened in the front rank, and their sub-commander and his two guards strode toward us. Any instructions? Asked Graham. Try to look intimidating, I replied. Graham straightened, tightening his grip on Thorn. Yes, my lord. That was for Myra, I said with a smirk. I only brought you to look pretty, Graham. He gave me a bewildered look that reminded me so much of Dorian it made me want to hug him, while Myra stifled a laugh. Mentally, I reached out to Myra, creating a new link without taking her hand. You're much better at reading thoughts. Since we don't share their language, I'll need you to try and interpret for me. Her reply was a warm glow. I could feel her love and trust. Of course. Though I'd only recently learned of her existence, I realized she truly considered me her father. It was a humbling sensation, and I began to doubt my decision to bring her with me. My intention had been to use her for this in order to protect my real daughter. Now I felt as though I'd just substituted one family member for another.
Don't worry, came Myra's mental voice. The body of a spell beast is much harder to destroy than one of flesh and blood. You made the right decision.
The strangers finished their walk, stopping 5 feet away. I met their sub-commander's eyes squarely, though they were nearly 2 feet lower than my own. Most of his face was obscured by a metal helmet that covered his head and cheeks, leaving only a wide gap for his eyes and mouth. His skin was a dark brown and appeared thick and rough, almost like cowhide. When he opened his lips to speak, a long series of clicks and strange staccato sounds emerged.
They greet you as an unknown enemy of indeterminate social standing, Myra told me.
You are also unknown to me. I would like to know why you have entered my lands in such a threatening manner, I said aloud, but before Myra could attempt to relay my meaning, the sub-commander gasped, his eyes narrowing as though I had offered some offense.
They seem shocked, Myra explained. He thinks you've used a type of language reserved for intimate communication with a lover.
Well, that's inconvenient, I replied. So, they do use words of some sort, but not for day-to-day talk. Myra nodded.
That seems to be the case.
Spreading my arms wide in a gesture meant to convey peaceful intentions, I spoke again. We mean you no harm. That earned me a rapid-fire burst of strange sounds between the sub-commander and his two guards.
They're trying to decide if you're deliberately insulting them, said Myra.
This was pointless. Try to connect directly with his mind, I told her. We'll never get anywhere like this. You can relay my thoughts directly to him. I felt her aether begin to move as a thin line stretched out to connect Myra to the enemy sub-commander. But before anything could be relayed, the man began to scream. It wasn't a scream in the human sense, for it sounded more like the squeal an injured pig might make, high-pitched and ear-piercing in its volume. Without hesitation, the two enemy guards stepped forward, their axes flashing towards me and Myra. Thorn knocked one axe away before it even reached my shield, and Graham's backstroke dipped down below the enemy shield before flying upward. Both of the strange man's arms were severed, and a portion of his helmet went flying as the impossibly sharp sword, driven by Graham's unnatural strength, tore through his flesh and armor. My reaction was slower, but not by much. I used my power to slam all three of them away with a blast of pure force, but the result was underwhelming. My magic should have struck them like a battering ram, but instead it fell apart, skittering across their bodies and draining away like water from a duck. The other guard's axe slammed into Myra, ripping through her shield and cutting her magical body nearly in half. I felt her pain screaming in my head as she collapsed. Then I saw him lift the axe again, glaring at me with coal black eyes. Enraged, I let a single word fall from my lips. Pyron. Burn. I already knew my magic wouldn't touch him directly, so I ignited the air around him, pouring my strength into it until the heat threatened to blister my skin just from standing so close to him. The guard screamed briefly as his body was charred and blackened, but the heat stole the breath from his lungs almost immediately. He slumped, dying in front of me, and I saw the sub-commander had fled during the commotion. Graham stopped short of chasing him, for the enemy crossbowmen were leveling their weapons at us. Muttering a command, Graham changed his greatsword to a one-hander and shield. That bastard isn't getting away, I cursed mentally. Reaching toward him with one hand, I used my power to rip the earth upward from beneath the sub-commander's feet in a solid chunk. Then I used it to propel him violently back toward us. The enemy leader sailed through the air over our heads to slam into the castle shield 50 yards behind us. He struck the solid wall of magic and slid to the ground, unmoving. Pain flared in my left leg, below the knee, then again in my right shoulder. The sound of missiles striking metal rang in my ears as Graham's shield stopped the majority of the crossbow quarrels fired at us. Looking down, I saw that two had gotten past him. One had gone completely through my leg, while the other was buried in my chest. The enemy crossbowmen were spread out in a line that was far too long for Graham to protect me from those firing from the ends. Somehow the missiles had passed through my personal shield without breaking it. How did they do that? There was no time to think, though. The front line was charging toward us, hungry to avenge their fallen sub-commander. That suited me just fine. The sight of a large armed force charging directly at you isn't something most people ever see. In fact, it's a profoundly frightening experience. But my life was such that it wasn't my first time to witness it, and I was too angry to give a damn. I didn't let my rage make me stupid, though. I had a number of possible actions I could take, ranging from reckless to ineffective. Tossing those aside, I dipped one hand into my pouch and brought out a large handful of my old favorites, the iron bombs. Flinging them into the air, I used my power to spread them in a wide arc, settling them in amongst the enemy before I detonated them. It wasn't the most devastating thing I could have done to them, but it cost me little and it would buy me time. The explosion sent shockwaves through the air and sent bodies flying in every direction. In the seconds that followed, only Graham remained on his feet, for I'd fallen unceremoniously on my arse. To my right, I saw Myra struggling to rise, her aether body having already reformed. She looked weaker, but she was intact. I just needed to get her to safety. "Back, Graham! We need to get back to the wall!" I shouted. But the young knight didn't react to my words. "They can't hear me," I realized. From long experience, I'd learned to always shield my own ears when using the iron bombs, but Graham hadn't had the benefit of that protection. I was probably deaf. Fortunately, Myra realized it just as quickly. "We're retreating, Graham," she announced, broadcasting her thoughts to both of us. Then I saw the enemy scrambling to their feet. A few of them didn't rise, but only those that had been closest to the blasts. Most of them were getting up. It was hard to believe how incredibly tough their bodies were. Behind me, I felt the shield gate open. Matthew or Moira had decided to open it, probably to rescue us. "It'll be a bloodbath if they get in," I thought. With my children fighting, we might win, but the cost would undoubtedly be high. Pushing Myra ahead of me, I started toward the gate, knowing my stubborn offspring they wouldn't close the gate again until we made it back. The enemy was not only resilient, they recovered faster. Charging toward us on their short, thick legs, they would reach us before we made it. Graham came to the same conclusion, and he turned to buy us time. His sword and shield blurred again, becoming the greatsword once more. The enemy axemen reached him first, but he didn't hold his ground, otherwise they would have wrapped around him and been on Myra and me in a second. Instead, he skipped backward as he cut down the ones who reached him first. It was hard to believe such a large man could move like that, and I wondered what Dorian would have thought if he could have seen his son dancing with the blade. I'd have thought it was weird as hell, but he'd also have been proud. His movements were graceful and fluid, with sharp, whip-like counterpoints. At first glance, he appeared almost weightless, floating across the ground as he moved. But an experienced fighter would have noted how his feet were firmly set just before each strike, allowing him to deliver the maximum amount of power and then absorb the recoil. Graham, no, Sir Graham, for the young man was every inch the knight his father had been, danced backward, staying within a few feet of us as we retreated. Thorn's reach in his hands was close to 10 feet, and none survived to enter that space. Then the crossbowmen lifted their weapons again. They had taken the longest to recover, having had to not only regain their feet, but also to reload. Despite their distance and everything else going on around him, Graham noticed their preparations. Just before they loosed, he switched again, from greatsword back to arming sword and shield. Realizing I had to do something, I did what I should have done half a minute sooner. I shouted a word and released my power, creating an almost instantaneous fog to cover us and the enemy, obscuring their aim. Graham leapt in front of me as the first quarrels shot through the mist, catching a number of them on his shield. Several struck his legs and head, but his armor held, though the strike to his head sent him stumbling, half-stunned from the force of it. We needed something big, or we weren't going to make it the remaining 20 yards to safety. Pushing Myra hard, I yelled, "Keep running!" Then I stopped, letting my focus drift as my mind sought the silent strength of the earth. I was done playing nicely. If these new strangers wanted us dead, I would bury them instead. More crossbow bolts flew through the fog, and my concentration was ruined as they found me, first in my right thigh, then my hip. The pain was so intense I hardly felt the one that tore through my chest, piercing my heart. My heart stopped, and with it, the pain vanished. Chapter 24. The voice of the earth faded as the pain struck, but when it ended, another voice became much louder, drowning out everything else. The void howled around me, and releasing my fears, I claimed it. My perception changed. My mage side was still there, but it tasted different. The aether of my enemies became brighter, and it called to me, tempting me like a glass of water set before a man dying of thirst. Rising to my feet, I began to walk toward the buffet that had been laid out for me. Graham was the first that I passed in the fog, close enough that he saw me. "Mort!" he shouted. "That's the wrong way! Go back!" I paused, fighting the urge to take him. His heart beat strongly in his chest, and his life force shone brighter than that of anyone else on the field. More quarrels struck his armor, and I distantly felt another embed itself within my chest. Struggling to draw breath with my damaged lungs, I growled hoarsely at him, "Run!" Then I continued on toward our foes. The first was only a few feet away, blazing at me through the fog like a lighthouse on a stormy night. Unable to restrain myself, I lashed out at him before I was close enough to touch him. A thick umbilical of black power sprang forth, latching onto his head and neck. In less than the span of a heartbeat, I ripped the life out of him, gasping with pleasure as the energy flooded into me. I walked on, my stumbling gait becoming a confident stride. The next two I found at the same time. Moving quickly, I placed one hand on the nearest, who just raised his axe. I smiled as his eyes glazed and the weapon fell from his fingers as he sank to his knees. His friend chopped at me from the side, the power of his blow driving his axe almost halfway through my chest. I ripped the life out of that one without even looking at him, then resumed savoring the slow death of the one kneeling in front of me. My chest began healing as soon as I pulled the axe blade out. Then I removed two of the crossbow bolts, but more appeared almost as soon as I had. I decided not to bother, since they didn't particularly hinder my movement. I could take them out later. I killed more, reveling in the joy as the fire in my chest burned brighter. Graham was following me, cutting down those that approached me from the left, and I began to grow annoyed. Each life that died at his hands was one less for my feast. At last I could take no more, so I turned on him. The young knight nearly severed my arm before recognizing me, not that I'd have cared. I moved close, my face only inches from the transparent steel of his helm. I told you to run. Graham's face showed shock, and perhaps fear.
Mordecai, your eyes!
I placed my palm on his chest. My patience was done, but the enchanted steel resisted my effort to draw out his life force. Snarling, I pushed, and then he was airborne, flying across the field and back to the open shield gate. I didn't bother watching to see how he landed, but I felt a faint pang of regret. He's not my enemy, I thought. I shouldn't hurt him. Something flew out from the direction of Washbrook, a spinning plane of strange power almost 2 feet in width. It passed some 30 feet to my left. It was at waist height, and I could feel the Aethar attached to it, guiding it through the mist. Matthew was controlling it, and the spell sliced through the air and enemies alike without slowing. Frustrated at the loss of yet more prey, I focused my attention on the gate into Washbrook. Matthew stood there, while some of the men-at-arms helped Graham and Myra through. He held his metal hand out in front of him, and he projected a wide, flat plane of utter blackness from it, absorbing everything that the enemy fired at them. Was that a newer version of his fool's tesseract, I wondered. If so, did he mean to blow the enemy away, me included? No, that couldn't be it. He'd be fully enclosed if he had that sort of intention, and it would probably be too dangerous to risk so close to the town. Moira's mind reached out to mine, bridging the distance between us.
Father, come back.
Tell your brother to get back inside the walls. If he kills any more of my toys, I'll come and rip his soul out by the roots, I snarled mentally.
What's wrong with you?
She replied anxiously. And then I felt the link begin to change, driving more aggressively into my mind, trying to seize control. Rather than fight it, I latched onto the connection and began to pull, drinking in her vitality. She would release me or die. The connection broke almost instantly. My daughter was no fool. A dark feeling akin to pride washed over me, knowing that she hadn't been weak enough to let me kill her. Seconds later, the opening in the shield that protected Washbrook closed. My wish had been granted. During my brief pause to deal with the rebellion, I'd apparently killed several more of the enemy, but more of them were closing on me. Aethar was flashing in the air, and my fog began to disperse. The enemy had spellcasters. If the mist vanished, the enemy soldiers might be able to overwhelm me. I doubted they could kill me, but being hacked to pieces would probably hamper my ability to kill them. But I wasn't new to this game. I knew what I needed to do. Reaching out to the void, I touched the faint lines of darkness that still connected me to my recent victims, and then fed a portion of the dark power into them. As one, they began to rise from the ground, lifting their axes and turning on their former brothers in arms. The battle raged, and though I was outnumbered at first, the enemy soon realized that their advantage was a delusion. More of them fell, both at my hand and at the hands of my new servants, and each that fell rose again moments later, ready to serve. Strange clicks and noises rang out across the field as my foes began to cry out to one another in alarm. Their bizarre clicking was augmented by animal-like squeals of terror as panic began to spread among them. I directed my new helpers in an unorthodox strategy. Whereas most battlefield commanders were concerned with casualties and preserving their force, these things were not my concern. It didn't matter whether my servants were hacked apart. All I cared about was making certain that none of the living escaped. Therefore, I directed most of my troops to the edges of the field, herding their former comrades in toward the center, where I and a small knot of my guardians waited. Covered in blood, some my own, some that of others, I reveled in the slaughter. My wounds were gone. I'd removed the last of the bolts from my body, and the holes had vanished as I basked in the deaths of my foes. It was like standing beside a bonfire on a winter night. The cold dark swirled at the edges of the light, but the burning light of my enemy's dying heart fires surrounded me in warmth. In the beginning, when there were many of them, I didn't bother going slowly. I sent black whips out to grasp them, ripping their lives out and filling me with violent ecstasy. But as their numbers dwindled, I slowed my pace, taking them one and two at a time to prolong the fun. The last 10, I kept prisoner, struggling in the grip of my dead soldiers while I approached them individually. A hand on a cheek or throat, and they began to wilt before me, crumpling one by one as I devoured their lives. I paused when I reached the last one, their proud leader, now reduced to a terror-ridden lump of trembling flesh. I should make this one special, I thought. With a mental command, I had those holding him step away. To his credit, he bravely struck at me, but I caught his thick wrist in an iron grip. They began to weaken immediately, but I avoided killing him quickly. Perhaps I should open his throat, let the warm blood out. Some part of me rebelled at that thought. That wasn't normal. This wasn't me. Kill him and go home. That was all I needed to do. Clenching my will, I tore his life out and released his arm. Then I turned my back and walked toward Washbrook. My family was waiting. As I returned, I could see that all eyes were on me, whether it was the soldiers and militia on the walls and towers or those gathered within the city gate. Matthew and Moira were just outside that, but the shield remained closed as I drew near. Graham stood with them, though I could tell by his stance he was still nursing a few injuries. When I stopped a few feet from the barrier enchantment, they merely stared at me. "Open up," I commanded. "I don't think that's a good idea, Father," said Matthew, his tone neutral. I smiled, knowing he must be afraid I meant to kill him. While the thought had crossed my mind, it had passed as my bloodlust dissipated. They were my children, not my prey. I just had to convince them of my peaceful intentions. Glancing down at myself, I realized I was quite literally covered in blood. That, combined with the gruesome scene they'd just witnessed, had probably unnerved them. "I'm fine now," I said. "I'll admit I suffered a turn of battle madness, but it has passed now."
"That was more than battle madness," said Moira firmly. "Something happened to you. Something bad."
Then I noticed that the men on the walls were gone. In fact, no one was visible other than my two children and Graham. Was this some sort of trick? "What's going on?" I demanded, struggling to keep my growing irritation hidden. "His eyes turned black on the field," said Graham. "I saw them, just before he hurled me at the walls."
"Mum will be here in a minute," announced Matthew. "She wants to talk to you before you come in."
"Just open the gate," I said. "This isn't necessary."
Penny stepped out from the town gate.
"I'll be the judge of that, Mort."
She nodded at the three of them, and they withdrew, leaving us alone. Moving as close as she could, she stood just a couple of feet away, with the thrumming power of the barrier enchantment standing between us.
The heavy wood of the city gate closed after Graham and my children passed through it. I stared at her, and despite the heavy pulsing aether of the shield between us, I could see her heart flame, her estrelin, flickering within her. Compared to that of the others, it was a pale, wan flame. She was healthy physically, aside from her missing arm. Even the level of her aether was what one would usually expect for a normal human. But her estrelin was dangerously weak. In contrast to her outward health, her estrelin resembled that of an extremely elderly woman. It wasn't something I'd noticed before. Normally I only saw people's aether. Discerning the estrelin was only possible for me through a tight link, such as that formed for deep healing. I should have been paying closer attention to her. She never fully recovered after the battle with Mal'Goroth. At one point she'd given most of her life to me, feeding me her vitality to strengthen me while I struggled inside the Shi'ar spellweave that held my soul captive. It had nearly killed her, and she'd been deathly ill for weeks afterward. I'd wanted to believe she was the same. I should have made sure.
"I saw the fight from the chamber in the castle," she said, breaking me out of my reverie. "It was terrible. What happened to you? How is this possible? Did you become one of them again?"
"No, that wasn't it. It couldn't be." But even as I denied it to myself, I knew the truth. I'd been hearing the whispering voice of the void for years now, ever since I'd regained my humanity. Today, I'd let it fill me. By them, she meant the Shi'greth, undead monsters we'd spent years fighting. "Of course not," I answered hastily.
"Graham said you took a crossbow bolt through the heart," said Penny, her voice hard.
I nodded. "I did. It nearly killed me, but I healed it."
"Like the Shi'greth," she accused.
My anger from earlier had vanished, replaced by fear, not of her, but for her, fear of myself. "No," I declared, staring down at my hand. "I'm still in control of myself. What happened was temporary, like when I listened to the wind or the earth. I'm still human." She pointed, directing my attention over my shoulder.
"What about them?"
Behind me, forgotten, stood an army of inhuman soldiers, dead soldiers. With my mage sight, I could see the black cords binding them to me, connecting them to my silent, still heart. Whoops, I replied convincingly. The corner of Penny's mouth rose briefly, just a hint of a smirk at my poor attempt at humor, but it vanished as soon as it appeared.
I need better than a whoops, Mort. A lot of people depend on us.
Focusing my will, I severed the links, and an army's worth of man-like soldiers collapsed to the ground behind me. Meeting Penny's eyes again, I spoke. You're right. I wasn't even close to normal. I'm still not there. Give me a few minutes. Surprisingly, she lifted her arm over her head and gave the signal to open the shield gate. The barrier between us vanished.
I rejected you once, said Penny. Do you remember? I swore I'd never do it again. You sound like yourself to me.
She started forward as if to embrace me, but I stepped back quickly. Wait, it isn't safe yet. I could still see her faint astralin, and I feared that even a moment's touch would kill her. I needed to restore myself. I was still wrapped in the void. I could force my heart to beat, but that wasn't enough. If I released the connection, I'd probably collapse. Or maybe I would start living normally, I thought. I really had no idea. There was nothing physically wrong with my body anymore, but my intuition told me I might just fall dead if I released the void too suddenly. Perhaps if I replace it with something else first. Opening my mind, I listened, finding the deep, slow sound of the earth beneath me. I put all my attention on it, and it became louder. I forced my heart to beat and filled my lungs with air, and then I sank into the mind of stone. Pain shot through me, but faded as quickly as it came, dulling into insignificance as I expanded to become more, until my body comprised not just a human form, but the soil it walked upon. I studied that body. Its heart had grown still again. It needed something more. Drawing it down into myself, I transformed it, filling it with stone and fire. Then I contracted, making myself smaller, until that hot, rocky lump was my only flesh. Clawing my way upward from the darkness, I stood above ground once again, staring out at the world with alien eyes. My memory was fading, but the animal in front of me reminded me what I wanted. I wanted to be like it. Gradually I rebuilt the image of the... What was it again? Then I saw it. A man. That was me. That is me. I let it flow into me, and the world changed. Colors gained new meaning, and I felt the air on my skin. The woman, Penny was close by. Breathing, I felt my life moving within me, and my thoughts became fluid again. I watched her for several minutes, taking stock of myself and remembering who I was. Penny was patient, but eventually she spoke.
Mort.
I'm pretty sure, I said after a moment. When she came at me again, I held up my hand. Let me be sure. Then I bent down and put my hand on a patch of green grass, watching it to see what happened. I felt no life transfer, and when I removed my hand, the grass still looked green. Glancing up at Penny again, I realized I could no longer see her astralin. Yeah, I nodded. I think I'm me. She took my hand, and then she hugged me. Together, we walked back into Washbrook. Chapter 25. Where is everyone? I asked Penny. The town was empty, devoid of people. She laughed.
In the castle courtyard. I told Elaine not to open the Washbrook shield until everyone was safely within the castle shield. That way, if you really were insane, they'd be safe.
I frowned as I looked down into her brown eyes. What about you? Penny patted my cheek.
I'm with Stupid.
Hey, I muttered, mildly offended, but she cut me off.
Live or die, Mordecai. I'm in it with you. After everything that happened before, with the Shigreth, the Dark Gods, all of it, I promised myself I would never turn my back on you again.
I growled. That's a dangerous philosophy. With all the weird things that happened to me, I'd rather you think more about yourself. What would our children do if... Penny interrupted me again.
Stop and turn that sentence around. I've made my decision. If you want them safe, if you want us safe, then you'd better be more careful what you do or become.
Watching her from the corner of my eye as we walked, I knew I wouldn't win this argument. The wind tossed her soft brown hair and made me want to sigh,
while her empty sleeve made me wince. She'd suffered so much for me over the years, and yet I still couldn't protect her. Not from pain, not from the world, sometimes not even from me. "I don't deserve you," I muttered. She released my hand to signal Elaine to open the castle shield gate, then looked up at me.
"Shut up. You deserve more than you know. Nobody talks about my husband that way, not even you."
My guardsmen saluted as we entered, but kept their eyes on the ground, fearing to meet my gaze. I couldn't say I blamed them. What I'd just done was gruesome. Graham and Matthew stood in my path.
"We took the subcommander prisoner," Matthew informed me. "He's unconscious, but once he wakes, Maura can learn a lot from him."
I nodded, and then looked over his shoulder at Graham. "I'm sorry for what I did to you. How badly are you injured?" The young knight shrugged. "A cracked rib, nothing more. Moira already took care of it." I held his gaze. "Forgive me, Graham. You didn't deserve that. I was not myself." "It's already forgotten, my lord," he responded. "Maybe for you," I thought, "but I have to answer to your father in the next life. What would he think of my actions?" The silence was broken when Graham spoke again. "About the bodies." I stifled an inappropriate chuckle. I should have had them bury themselves before I released my newly created Shigareth. Penny answered before I could.
"Send a wagon and some men to strip the bodies, then organize the townsfolk. They can dig a trench to bury them."
"What about our guardsmen?" suggested Graham. "They should help." Penny responded in a neutral tone.
"We have met our duty to defend them. There are far too many for our men to deal with. You can detail half of the guards to assist, but keep the rest ready in case there are more enemies nearby. Make sure everyone is prepared to retreat within the walls if there's any sign of another attack."
I nodded in agreement. My wife had the right of it, though I'd been unable to say it myself. I was still in shock from what I'd done, and I wondered what should be done next. Matthew took the lead.
"No one's had lunch. After all that excitement, I'm sure everyone's hungry. Let's eat."
Of course, I should have thought of that, though perhaps part of the problem was that I was the farthest thing from being hungry. Unlike most battles, I'd emerged from this one feeling better than when I'd entered it. I was practically bursting at the seams with energy. Food was the last thing I needed. "Because you already ate enough for several lifetimes," I thought darkly. While everyone ate, I went home. I needed to think, so I left our mountain cottage and took to the air, flying up until the peaks of the Elentiers were beneath me and the world appeared small. It helped, seeing the world that way. It made my problems seem smaller, less overwhelming. Visions of what I'd just done kept creeping into my thoughts, but I pushed them aside. They weren't helpful, and I knew from long experience with such horrors that I would have plenty of time to revisit what had happened in my nightmares. "I'm a long way from the simple boy who lived at the smithy," I said to the landscape far below. "Every passing year seems determined to dye my soul a darker shade." That wasn't helpful, so I decided to list the current problems. A mysterious forest appears where Lancaster used to be, and somehow it's tied to the ancient Alineal Shi'har. A new race of people arrives and promptly attacks us for reasons I don't understand. Intelligent machines have invaded the world, secretly attempting to enslave all of humanity, or maybe just to remake our world according to their own vision. Meanwhile, the Shi'har I resurrected are led by my ancestor, who has no discernible morals and may or may not be on our side. It was human nature to seek a pattern. I wanted to believe all my problems were connected in some way that made sense, but I cautioned myself it could be a non sequitur. Some of these things could be entirely coincidental. The Shi'har initially came here to escape from an ancient enemy. Tyrion's suffering and eventual holocaust was part of their long game to find a way to save themselves. I and my children were one result of that. The Alineal Shi'har had been brought back as a result of our actions. Now Ansis, the ancient enemy of the Shi'har, was here, and ironically, my son had discovered during his recent travel that they were probably created by humanity as a response to a Shi'har invasion. Those things, fantastic as they were, had some sort of cause and effect, or perhaps even a circular cosmic cycle. But the disappearance of Lancaster and the appearance of this new enemy didn't seem to fit. It seemed possible that the new enemy came from the primeval forest we'd found, or from someplace like it. Those things might be connected, but they didn't fit in with the rest of it. Except for the fact that my son had detected translational magic at the borders of the strange territory that had replaced Lancaster.
That implicated the Alineal Shi'Ha, indicating it might be some sort of result of their millennia-long plan to protect themselves from Ansys. Then again, it might be something they'd done that was unrelated to that plan. Yet if they had done it, and I was ignorant of it, then it must have been part of the knowledge removed from the Loshti. That would tend to indicate it was part of the Shi'Ha's secret plan. Now that I've established that I'm essentially clueless regarding current events, what can I do to gain more information? I reminded myself. Focus on what you can do. Interrogating the prisoner was obviously our first and most promising source of potential information. Continuing Matthew and Gary's project to locate Ansys was equally important. I could also ask my son to investigate the magic around the border of the strange forest. It might help if we knew where it came from. It might also help to talk to Lorelianta. She hadn't received the Loshti, but being the last of the original Elenials, she might have some knowledge that would shed light on what their plans had been. I didn't relish the thought of another trip to their island, though, or the fact that even asking simple questions of her might take weeks of valuable time. You need to delegate more, stupid, I told myself. Moira was the obvious choice for extracting information from our prisoner, although I hesitated to put her in a situation in which she might break more of the rules the Centaur had created to protect themselves. She might also be able to speed up the time it took to gain information from Lorelianta, or discover answers the Shi'Ha meant to hide. Am I willing to put my own daughter at risk? I thought. I was only one man, but I had incredible resources at my disposal if I dared to use them. It really came down to whether I prioritized the safety of the world or my family. My first instinct was to keep them safe, to try and do everything myself, but was that really in their best interest? My oldest children were grown, but if I didn't allow them to leave the shelter of home, they'd never become true adults. Honestly, the same was true of the Queen and the nation of Lothian. My actions in the past had been founded on the assumption that only I could protect them. They needed to be given the information and power to do so for themselves. My only previous attempt to do that had been the creation of the Knights of Stone, but they were gone now. There were only a few surviving members of that order. Sion, Harold, Egan, William, and Thomas, and none of them had the Earthbond anymore. After a period of years, it became too dangerous, slowly converting the men so bonded into golems of earth and stone. I'd broken their bonds when they began to show signs of the change. We needed them back. I wasn't willing to subject more people to the Earthbond, but the dragons I created were the perfect solution for that. I'd just been too cautious to use them, giving them only to a few family members and the Queen. That'll change, I muttered. Having resolved myself, I dropped from the sky, stooping toward the ground, and only slowing myself just before I reached the doorstep of my home. Connell was standing there, and he opened the door for me. I wish you'd teach me to do that, he said. It's too dangerous, I know. You tell me that every time, he groused. But you learned it. I frowned. I don't think you want to go through what I did to learn it. Sooner or later, everyone who's tried flying this way has wound up dead, usually sooner rather than later. But you keep doing it, Connell reminded me as he led the way. Elaine and Elise have been examining the prisoner. They want you to come see him. I followed my younger son, thinking on what he'd said. My flying skill was such that it was unlikely I would kill myself unless I lost consciousness while in the air, but today's events made me wonder. Could I die? I'd just been shot through the heart, and here I was wondering about it. Had my internal transformation only been possible because I was already starting to listen to the Earth when it happened, that might have made it easier to touch the void. What if I was killed while unconscious? What if I was decapitated while conscious? I was pretty sure those things would be fatal, but I couldn't be entirely certain, not anymore. There might be nothing more between me and becoming a monster than the beat of my heart. When I'd been trapped as a Shi'Greth before, it had been an artificial copy of myself making the decisions, while I was trapped as an observer within the Shi'Ha's immortality spellweave. That was not the case anymore. I was the one who crossed the line this time, and it hadn't been easy to come back. If it happened again, I wasn't sure I would want to come back. And it felt so good. It was like being drunk. My inhibitions had been gone, leaving me free to indulge my darker impulses. Pain had been a thing of the past, and killing had felt natural, pleasurable. Even now, the void was only a heartbeat away, waiting for me to listen to it, to give it power and expression. The example of Gareth Galen was a warning. An archmage could easily lose control, giving themselves over to the impulses and drives of whatever they became. In his case, he'd become a dragon, and after slaughtering his enemies, he'd turn claw and fang on his friends and allies, and it had taken him 1,000 years to regain his humanity. I was on the precipice of something far worse.
Connell pulled up short in front of me. They're inside.
We were at a stone enclosure in the castle yard, near the barracks. It was originally a small storage building, but it had been repurposed as a jail cell. During a previous war, I'd felt a lack for not having a dungeon, but once peace returned, I hadn't bothered to build one. On the few occasions I needed to lock someone up, I usually borrowed Lancaster's facilities. A guard opened the door, and inside there were two more, along with Elaine Prathian and Elise Thornbear. Their patient lay on a small cot. He was still unconscious, but his hands and feet were chained to an iron ring set in the wall as a precaution. "What have we learned?" I asked them. As usual, Elise didn't mince words.
"I think he's human."
"He's got two arms and legs, two eyes, all of that," I responded. "But beyond that, he seems too different."
Elaine piped up.
"He has all the same internal organs we do."
"So do bears," I countered.
"It's more than that," said Elise waspishly. "I've had Elaine examining him carefully, comparing his internal body structures to mine for comparison. While he's different in stature and proportion, everything else is too similar. Even the patterns of hair growth on his body are the same."
"Hair?" I mumbled. Elise raised one brow.
"Want me to undress him and show you?"
I gave her a hard glare. "That won't be necessary. You're telling me that he's deformed, like a dwarf or midget."
"He isn't misshapen," said Elise. "And there are 700 other bodies out there on the field that are just like him. I think he's from some race of men that we've never encountered before."
"And they just appear on our doorstep ready for war," I muttered. "None of this makes sense. Perhaps we'll learn more when he's awake."
I left and found Penny and Moira waiting for me outside. Penny smiled briefly.
"Learn anything?"
Her expression was normal, trusting, but Moira's eyes studied me carefully. I could sense her wariness. She was probably still wondering if I was safe. When I couldn't blame her, I was wondering the same thing.
"Elise thinks he's human, but other than the fact that they're very similar to us, we don't know much," I told her. Then I added, "I'd like Moira to sift through his mind when he wakes up." Penny glanced between me and our daughter, a look of concern showing in the lines of her face.
"Is that safe for her?"
Though she didn't understand the particulars of what Moira had done in Dunbar, she knew that messing around in the heads of others was what had gotten our daughter in trouble. I decided to be honest. I doubt Moira sent here would agree, but I'm inclined to trust her. My daughter's eyes locked onto mine.
"According to her, I'm already a monster."
Deep down, I could almost hear a silent addition to her reply. "And you might be one, too." "Your choices are your own," I told her. "I firmly believe that. Monster, human, whatever labels we call ourselves, what matters is our actions. In the end, it's our actions that define us, not the opinions of others."
Penny looked back and forth between us.
"Dramatic statements like that don't really do much to reassure me. I hope you realize that."
Moira's features softened.
"I'll be all right, Mum."
Then she asked me,
"How far do you want me to go with this?"
"I'll trust you to make that decision. Do whatever you feel necessary, whatever you can do without damaging yourself." My daughter nodded, and then without warning, she took my hand. I felt the beginning of a tentative link, and I allowed it. After a brief inspection, she spoke in my mind.
"Thank you."
"What for?" I replied.
"Trusting me, and allowing me to see your mind. I couldn't be sure you were still you until now."
I smiled. "Actually, I was wondering the same thing. You've set my mind at ease." Moira dropped my hand before announcing,
"I'll stay here then. The prisoner is starting to come around."
"He's awake?" I asked.
"No," said Moira. "There are levels to consciousness. When we first brought him in, he was still out cold, and his mind was silent. But I can feel it now. He's dreaming again. Now he's like someone who's fallen asleep."
Penny and I left her there. But as we walked back to the keep, Penny asked me,
"Are you sure she'll be safe?"
I shook my head.
"Nope."
Her face turned to worry before I could add, "But it's the right decision. You convinced me of that."
"I did."
"Mm-hmm," I answered. "Your little speech after I came back to my senses."
"I told you to be more careful with yourself," she growled, "not to take more chances with our children."
"You also told me you trust me no matter what," I responded. I did some thinking, but I realized I need to apply that same reasoning to others. Matthew and Moira are grown now. We have to let them take risks, or they'll never be anything more than children.
And if they make terrible mistakes?
Asked Penny. Then we do what parents do. We pick up whatever pieces are left and clean up the mess, I told her. Chapter 26 That evening, Penny and I sat in the living room of our mountain home, enjoying a moment of peace. We were about to have a second cup of tea when the Queen of Lothian entered the room, surprising us. Well, technically she surprised Penny. I'd seen her enter through the portal down the hall about 20 seconds earlier. Interestingly, she didn't come alone. The man that followed after her was above average in height, perhaps 5 feet and 11 inches. He had broad shoulders and a muscular build that matched his thick moustache and beard. I jumped up to greet them, while Penny scampered out the other door with a strangled eep as she sought to find something better to cover herself. It wasn't that she was exposed in any way, but she must have thought her ratty old housecoat inappropriate for such high-ranking guests. Egan, I cried, before giving the man a bear hug. I haven't seen you in ages. Sir Egan had once been one of my knights, and though he now paid obeisance to the Queen, he was one of the few remaining knights of stone. In fact, he was a member of 2 orders of knighthood, being also a founding member of the Knights of the Thorn. The Knights of the Thorn were an order created by the Queen herself, and they were so named to honor Dorian Thornbear's sacrifice. A rough-looking man by all measures, Egan stiffened in my arms. The Queen, he hissed in my ear. I laughed. If we'd been at court, my greeting him first would have been a major breach of protocol. I held on to him, winking at Ariadne over one of his shoulders. Don't be so shy, Egan. I see little Harry every day almost, but it's been ages since you came to visit. I pushed him out to look at him from arm's length, and then used my hands to ruffle his thick beard playfully. Damn, you look good. Aren't they feeding you? A man of nearly 40 should have a little extra around the middle by now. Sir Egan stepped back, turning to address Ariadne, who was openly laughing at his discomfort. My queen, please forgive... The queen grinned mischievously at him.
Egan, I told you once already. This is an informal setting. Mort's my cousin, and he's been sharing his home with me. Let the etiquette and protocols go for a while.
To emphasize her point, I swept Ariadne into another hug, and then kissed her soundly on the cheek. Sir Egan gave me a thoroughly disapproving look. I see now why you aren't encouraged to come to court more often. It was that point at which Penny returned. She still wore a housecoat, but this one was longer, heavier, and embroidered. It wasn't formal wear by any stretch of the imagination, but it did at least look like something a noblewoman would wear at home. Egan's face lit up at the sight of her, and he almost forgot himself. He ducked his head respectfully toward the Queen, who was now standing comfortably next to me, tucked under my arm. Your Majesty, if I may.
Ariadne frowned. I told you to relax.
The gruff knight nodded, and then stomped across the floor to embrace my wife. Penny, how have you been? His demeanor on meeting her was completely different from his manner with me. Ariadne looked up at me, a question in her eyes, but I merely shrugged, as if to say, how should I know? Penny seemed equally enthused to see him, and the two of them nearly forgot about us as they greeted each other. They seemed so excited that I thought for a minute they might begin to hold hands and hop around in circles, but they managed to restrain themselves. Then Egan focused on Penny's missing arm. I heard the terrible news. I only wish I could have been there to help, he told her, half apologizing. Penny pursed her lips before replying.
What's done is done. Let's not talk about it. Would you like some tea?
Then she remembered the Queen.
And you too, Ariadne, of course.
It was a testament to her fortitude that she managed not to call her Your Majesty. Over the past week, Ariadne had worked hard at making Penny more comfortable with her presence. She'd only partially succeeded, primarily in getting Penny to drop the honorifics. Both of them nodded affirmatively, and my wife started for the kitchen, but Sir Egan quickly followed her, offering his assistance. Ariadne and I were left alone, so we sat down.
I had no idea they were such good friends,
observed the Queen. They fought together through some hard times while I was away, I noted. Sharing a battle makes close friends of men who fought side by side. I would think it's the same for men and women. By away, I was delicately referring to my exile as an undead monster. Egan and Dorian had fought shoulder to shoulder with Penny to help extract my family and the Thornbear family from Albemarle while the Duke Tremont had occupied it. Ariadne patted my hand affectionately.
That's true, but he didn't seem nearly as happy with your welcome.
I sighed. I don't think he's ever been completely comfortable with me after our encounters back then. In fact, Megan had been guarding my family on two separate occasions, and he'd been forced to protect them from me. In one encounter, he'd nearly burned me to ash with his sun sword, and in the second, I'd wounded him badly before sucking some of the life out of him to heal my injured son. Despite the fact I'd been his first liege and the one to knight him, Megan had plenty of unpleasant memories regarding me. I really couldn't blame him if he still felt uncomfortable around me. After a few minutes, Penny and Egan returned, carrying a tray laden with cups. They sat and made themselves comfortable. But before the conversation could begin, Lady Rose appeared.
"Did I smell freshly brewed tea?"
She stiffened at the sight of Sir Egan in the room. Egan stood and bowed respectfully. "Lady Hightower." Rose recovered from her surprise almost instantly. She crossed the room and found a chair, but before sitting, she answered,
"Sir Egan, I see that you are well."
I watched her studiously. Rose wasn't the only one capable of careful observation, though I was far more prone to lapses in judgment than she was. It had been so long since any of Dorian's fellow knights had visited that I'd almost forgotten her dislike for them. It wasn't that she nursed an active grudge, but the events surrounding and following her husband's death had left her with a certain amount of prejudice against them. It had been Egan who held her back when she tried to join Dorian beneath the monolith that crushed him. She'd forgiven him for that, but later, when the Order of the Thorn had been created, she'd been vehemently against their use of some of her husband's things as memorials in their chapter house. In particular, her husband's broken greatsword, the same one her son now wielded after Matthew had remade it. It was practically considered a relic. She'd refused to let Sir Harold have it, even though the Knights of the Thorn had been named after it. The most telling sign of her distraction was the fact that Rose was so focused on Sir Egan that she didn't notice the Queen until she began to sit. Despite the enforced rule of familiarity in my house, she wouldn't dare sit down before at least addressing her monarch, not intentionally at least. She jerked to a halt as her eyes lit on Ariadne.
Ariadne, my apologies, I didn't see you there.
Ariadne smiled.
Don't worry about it, Rose. Sit down.
Penny started to rise to fetch Rose a cup, but Egan beat her to the punch. When he returned, he took it upon himself to fill the cup before handing it to Rose. "Since you're here so early, I'm guessing you already heard of our doings today," I said, beginning the inevitable conversation. Rose coughed lightly, and I got the sense I'd made a mistake. Then Ariadne answered,
"Actually, no. We've had our own troubles today, but please, fill me in. I'll share my news afterward."
I glanced at Penny, and I could see she was just as clueless as I was, but the look in Rose's eyes held a distinct message. She'd already observed something. She'd probably known that Ariadne had some news and thought I was foolish for speaking first. It was too late to correct that, however, so I launched into a concise retelling of the events of the day. I spared little as I recounted the details, other than summarizing my victory over the invaders as a major feat of magic. Ariadne would probably get a grislier account later from others, but I had no stomach for it. I included the fact that we had a prisoner who spoke no known tongue, and Elise Thornbear's speculation about his humanity. Ariadne's face was graven with disapproval when I finished.
"I know we're being informal here, but I'm sorely tempted to put my crown on and make a formal decree after hearing that."
"Am I not allowed to defend my citizens and holdings?" I asked sincerely.
"That's not the problem, Mordecai, and you know it,"
declared my cousin, the Queen of Lothian.
"How would you feel if I went to war and led the charge against an army?"
"I'm not the Queen, Ari, you are," I replied sharply. "It's not that uncommon for noblemen to take the field."
"You aren't some lowly knight or small baron,"
stated Ariadne. Leaning back, I answered in a dismissive tone, "That may be true, but it isn't unheard of for even the greater lords to take the field." Ariadne's eyes took fire.
"I don't need a history lesson from you, Mort. And you weren't leading an army. You went out to parley alone, and then you fought a major battle by yourself."
"I had some help," I insisted, but Penny ruined my statement by punching my shoulder. My wife gave Ariadne a sympathetic look.
"I agree with you. He took almost no support with him."
Ariadne smiled at her.
"I should probably command him to stay off the battlefield if this happens again."
Penny nodded enthusiastically.
"You should."
I glanced between the two of them, and then at Rose and Egan. There wasn't a sympathetic face in the room. "You can order whatever you like, but I'll do as I see fit according to the situation," I said defiantly. Sir Egan choked on his tea, and after a fit of coughing, he spoke out loudly. "Let's open contempt for the crown." The Queen stared him down.
Egan, don't make me repeat myself again. This is a meeting of friends and family. Don't ruin it for me.
Rose sniffed.
Politics is a poor topic for family and friends, but if we're going to speak of it, I think there are a few things you should consider, Mordecai.
I took a deep breath. I'm listening. Rose looked at the Queen.
You'll forgive me if I speak frankly.
Ariadne nodded, so Rose continued.
Mordecai, while your rank as the Count de Cameron puts you in the lower upper end of the peerage, you are in reality the most powerful nobleman in the kingdom. You are very nearly as important as the Queen herself.
Egan choked again, and Ariadne began pounding on his shoulders as if to help him, though I suspected she was also helping to cut off his outraged response. You're overstating things, Rose, I argued. Rose's brow went up.
No, I am not, and I believe the Queen agrees with me. What do you think would happen to Ariadne's position if you were to die suddenly?
Not a damn thing, I declared confidently.
Her position as the first ruling queen in Lothian's history would be in jeopardy. It was never a popular decision to put her on the throne. It was merely the least distasteful option. She has been in power long enough now that most have grown accustomed to it, but dissent will grow quickly if you were to disappear,
explained Rose. I'm not the only wizard in Lothian anymore, I countered, and every wizard in Lothian is firmly in her camp. Not only that, but Matthew would support her. No matter what happens to me, she'll have Cameron behind her. And she has a dragon. The lords wouldn't dare turn against her. Rose dipped her head deferentially.
I'll grant that the dragon was a masterful stroke, and it does indeed strengthen her position. But your son is an unknown in the world of politics. He does not command the same respect. You are the most feared man in Lothian. Your mere existence does more to silence the Queen's critics than every other factor combined.
I chuffed. I doubt they fear me that much. Then you'd be wrong, said Egan honestly. Your deeds are the stuff of legend. More like the stuff of nightmares, I thought, but I was grateful for Egan's tasteful wording. I leaned forward. Even so, Egan, you make a point in my favor. Today was yet another of those deeds. Once the story gets out, they'll be reminded that I haven't lost my teeth. Penny surprised me by setting her teacup down firmly. It startled me more that she didn't break it, which was more her style when upset. Instead, she was calm and composed. And when she spoke, it was in a fashion I would have expected from Rose rather than my wife.
Please forgive my husband, she said, directing her words to the rest of the room. He is almost certainly the most frustrating man I've ever known.
Then she set her eyes on me and continued in a fashion I was more familiar with.
I often dream of strangling him and putting myself out of my misery.
Everyone laughed, but I had to correct her. No, you'd have to strangle yourself to put you out of your misery.
You are my misery, Penny said firmly. It would put me out of my misery whether I was strangling you or whether I was strangling myself.
More laughter followed, and I chuckled. Still, it would be clearer if you said,
Don't be a pedant, Mordecai, Rose abjured me. It isn't very becoming of you.
I sighed, looking around me. I couldn't win. Fine, you're all right. It was stupid of me to go out there today, I admitted. However, I reserved the right to be stupid in the future. There's no help for it.
How so?
Asked Ariadne innocently. Well, I wouldn't expect any of you to understand, not being wizards, but my magic is founded on stupidity. If I tried to change that, I would lose my powers, I told them grandiosely.
Oh, is that so?
Asked Penny incredulously. I nodded. I'm pretty sure it is. In fact, I'm pretty sure that the motto of the Alineal line of wizards is Stupid Never Dies. There was more laughter. And Rose snorted in a decidedly unladylike fashion before speaking up.
What a bold lie you are. The wizardly lineages don't have any mottos, not that I've ever heard of.
Well, they do now, I declared. I'll just need to add it to the banners. The mood had lightened, but after a minute, Sir Egan brought us all back to the seriousness of the present. Your news regarding this attack is disturbing, and, unfortunately, it seems it may connect with what the Queen has to share.
Have there been other attacks?
Asked Penny.
We aren't sure, said Ariadne. In Albemarle we have several reports of small villages being attacked by strange creatures. While most of them aren't enough for me to fear some sinister plot, there have been several deaths. What concerned me most is a report from the Duke of Cantley stating that the entire populace of the market town Broddington has vanished.
Vanished? Like Lancaster? I asked worriedly. Ariadne shook her head.
No, the place is still there, but the inhabitants are missing. Being a market town, this was noticed almost immediately, as people go there to trade daily. Our best guess is that this happened some 3 nights ago, and was discovered the following morning. Duke Cantley sent a force of men to investigate, and they reported signs of a struggle, but no bodies were found. Where is Broddington?
Penny questioned. A day and a half east-northeast of Cantley, on the northern bank of the Surrey River, I answered. Geography was an important subject of study for the nobility, but I had the advantage of my near-perfect memory.